growing up in Baghdad today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A teen in Baghdad takes up the cello. She plays it to escape.
People my age are supposed to, you know, worry about their studies and having fun. But here, you worry about how are you going to live if things got worse.
Plus, a Puerto Rican journalist tries to ride out the island's economic storm.
My roots are here. I don't know how long I'll actually be able to stay. It's something that me and my generation and everybody around me thinks about constantly. Should I stay or should I go?
Which brings me to The Clash and a photographer punk enough to document the London scene in the early 80s.
Soft punk, though. Didn't have the piercings. I did have the bright pink hair and the bright green hair and the crazy mohair tops.
It's all coming up today here on The World. Glad you could be with us. We start today in Iraq. You know, it seemed it was a long time ago when Iraq was in our headlines every day. Today, though, that doesn't feel so distant, especially with the news of protesters storming the Green Zone in Baghdad over the weekend. That is the heavily fortified part of the city where the U.S. Embassy and Iraqi government offices are located. So it was a big deal that the protesters managed to get in the Green Zone and take over the Iraqi parliament. Reporter Jane Araf is based in Baghdad. I asked her what the protesters were angry about.
Well, Marco, they're angry about pretty much everything because they've basically had 13 years to get angry. If we flash back to the invasion of Iraq and all those promises that were made, basically they were told they were not only getting democracy, that they would be getting everything else that they deserve in this very rich country. But they've gotten none of that. Services are terrible. There's hardly any electricity. And if you're young, there's a good chance you would have had to drop out of school because you couldn't afford to stay in school. If you did stay in school, you might not be able to get a job. There's incredible poverty, and life is just not very nice in Iraq right now.
And how alarming is it that protesters entered the security cordon of the Green Zone? And it had also been closed off to nearly all Iraqis, right?
Yes, that's one of the many ironies in this. The Green Zone was Saddam Hussein's palace. So when the Americans came in 2003, they decided to base their operations actually in his palace in the middle of Baghdad. And then it expanded. And when the Iraqi government took over, they didn't do away with the Green Zone. They expanded it further, put up more concrete blast walls to keep out car bombers. But in doing that, they've also kept out Iraqis. So a lot of those Iraqis who are protesting would never be allowed in the Green Zone. You can't get in or out unless you're an official or you have a special badge or you work there. So it took on this mythical importance. And for a lot of the protesters that I've talked to over the past few weeks, the Green Zone for them became this incredible symbol of corruption, of everything that was wrong in Iraq. And they wanted to get in there. They wanted to make a point. And on a very simple level, they just wanted to see what was inside.
So today, a car bombing in Baghdad. What did the attacks and the protests over the weekend tell us about the stability of Iraq right now, Jane?
I think Marco tells us a couple of things. It tells us that almost everything is intertwined in Baghdad. Essentially, these car bombs are happening partly because we're in the middle of a major Shia holiday where millions of people take to the roads and they do a pilgrimage to a major shrine in Baghdad. So it's occasions like that that have proved to be a major target. But the connection with those attacks and the stability of Iraq is that the Iraqi government doesn't have very tight control anymore, either on the political situation or the security situation. And this is the worst political crisis since 2003.
Can you just sum up what that political crisis is all about?
It's essentially about who gets to govern the country. It's as simple as that. So the Kurds have a share, the Shia parties have a share, the Sunni parties have a share, and they've gotten to decide which ministers run different cabinet posts. But the idea now is that you throw away all of that and you actually get people who are qualified to run those ministries. That isn't tied to political parties, that provides services, but we're not even there yet.
Jane, a lot of the protesters, as we saw this weekend, going to the Green Zone are young Iraqis, and I know you've been speaking with some of them for our Global Post team. What have you been hearing?
Well, you know, one of the themes in Iraq really is the wasted potential, the potential of resources, the potential of all that money that it has. And more than that, the potential of young people who are really quite extraordinary and very resilient in many cases. One of them was a young woman named Asala. She's 19 years old and she lives in Baghdad. And like most young Iraqis, she's seen a lot of violence and she worries. She worries about what will happen to her. She worries about what will happen to her country. She's unhappy at home. She's unhappy at school, but she's discovered music. And she says that might just save her.
Let's hear her story.
There's this Beethoven piece. It's called For Alice. It's a piano piece. And I always heard it playing around when I was young. I never know what it was called or who composed it. But then I grew up and became a musician and found this piece. I was so happy. I really always loved this piece. Families in here just want their kids to become engineers or doctors or something like that. So being a musician and a female at the same time in here is really hard. Like, maybe it would be easier for me if I was a guy. Like, maybe they wouldn't control me as much. Maybe somewhere else you would be able to work at a coffee shop or a restaurant or at a supermarket or something, but here it doesn't work like that. There aren't even cafes that hires, you know, young ladies. And it's the same at a supermarket or such. Like, even if you could find a job at a supermarket, they're like, oh, she's a girl, she's working here, oh, her family is, you know, probably didn't raise her well, she's bad, she's, yeah, like, girls here have to deal with all of this. Like, you can probably just breathe and get judged. People my age are supposed to, you know, worry about their future and studies and are searching for job, you know, and having fun. But here, you worry about bigger stuff, like how are you going to live if things got worse, you know? Pretty much, death is surrounding you, so it's really depressing. Like, at this age, you're supposed to have fun and go out and stuff, but here, you deal with so much bigger thing than you. Living here is horrible, you know? But when you play, you don't feel like you belong here. You're like, it's only you, your instrument, and the sound you're creating. And it's such a great feeling whenever, like, you play in tune note. It makes you feel super good about yourself and all. Like, I'm creating something. At the moment, I'm creating something and I'm liking it.
That's the cello of 19-year-old Asala. She was telling her story to reporter Jane Araf. You can read Jane's story about Asala and other young Iraqis who have grown up only knowing sanctions, war, and violence. It's up right now on our Tumblr. That's at pritheworld.tumblr.com. When I say Islamic State, we think ISIS, right? Well, we shouldn't forget that al-Qaeda also wants to declare its own Islamic State at some point. In fact, al-Qaeda's branch in Syria, known as the Nusra Front, is laying the groundwork for just that. And some top analysts are saying the Nusra Front might actually pose a bigger threat than ISIS in the long term.
In Syria, they've been presented with a historic opportunity.
Richard Hall is in Beirut for our Global Post team.
They've taken advantage of the chaos that the Syrian civil war has provided them, and they've attempted to build roots in the country. They've captured territory and administered territory for the first time. What's really interesting is that they've actually pursued a strategy of not antagonizing the West in order to achieve this aim in Syria. They had orders from Zawahiri saying that they should not plan attacks against the West from Syria. They should focus on building the emirate in Syria. But what Nusra has said is that they'd only do this in Syria when they've consulted all the major power brokers. So they want to do it when the time is right, and they're just waiting for that moment.
So what's life been like in towns and cities that are under Nusra rule? Are there many of them?
The major case is Idlib, which is a major city in northern Syria. It's a major provincial capital, and it was really the first time that Nusra has run a major city like this. And as part of our reporting, we spoke to a lady called Rana, who lived in Idlib until a month ago. And she spoke to us about what it was like to live there. And you hear her talk, she could easily be talking about ISIS-controlled territory. I mean, you see the reports of both things, and they don't sound that much different, apart from the brutality that ISIS inflicts on the subjects under its control.
Right. Now, there are other rebel groups, and some of them are being supported by the United States. How close is the Nusra Front to those rebel groups?
This is something that chops and changes all the time. This is why it's been so difficult for the U.S. and Russia to come to an agreement on what happens in northern Syria, because Nusra, as far as Russia is concerned, Nusra is working with the moderate groups that the U.S. is supporting. The U.S. says, well, wait a minute, these groups are very different. They have different ideologies.
Mm. I mean, the thing, though, is right now, I mean, the clear target is ISIS. And what's the strategy for the United States then and its coalition partners for Nusra, for example? I mean, how willing are these partners, how willing is the United States to turn Nusra, which is basically al-Qaeda, but not as bad as ISIS, into our partner to fight ISIS?
Well, the U.S. declared Nusra a terrorist organization very early on in the Syrian civil war. So as far as the U.S. is concerned, Nusra is the same as ISIS, and they will wipe it out whenever they can. The problem is in actually doing this, when Nusra is so ingratiated with the Syrian opposition and when it fights alongside them in many places, it's been very difficult for the U.S. to actually hit them effectively.
So I guess what I'd like to know is, if the U.S. and its coalition partners manage to defeat ISIS, that still means there's the Nusra Front. Then they have to go after the Nusra Front?
Exactly. I mean, for any sort of settlement to be reached between the Syrian government and the opposition, Nusra's not going to be part of that. So the U.S. needs to figure out a way to convince all the Syrian opposition groups who are fighting alongside Nusra in some of these areas to kind of completely split away from them. And that's going to be a really hard process, because for most of these rebel groups, Assad is the number one enemy. He's the one bombing their towns and cities. And Nusra, I mean, for all their faults, they are an ally in the fight against Assad. So breaking those two groups apart is going to be very difficult.
So when we talk about the Nusra Front in Syria, what do you think is the takeaway for all of this?
Well, it's difficult. Very influential analysts will tell you that Nusra is the bigger, longer-term threat. They've ingratiated themselves so much in the Syrian opposition, they'll be very hard to dislodge. And we may even have to come to some sort of agreement with them.
Rich Hall in Beirut with our Global Post team. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks very much, Marco.
A quick look at what's coming up later on the show. We'll have a story about my BBC colleague, Nkem Ifejika. He lives in London, but is originally from Nigeria. And over the years, he's heard his name pronounced a million different ways. It got so bad, he couldn't even pronounce it correctly himself.
My wife, she would tease me. She was half scornful, half teasing. She'd say, you don't even know how to pronounce your name. My wife, by the way, is Nigerian, and she's Igbo, which is the ethnicity that I'm from in southeastern Nigeria. So she'd say, you don't even know how to say your name.
Now he's decided to change that. His story is coming up right here on The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs for answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform. Tune in to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
It seems like big news. An Australian by the name of Craig Wright is claiming to be the creator of Bitcoin. That's the still somewhat mysterious virtual currency created by an even more mysterious person, previously known only by the pseudonym Satoshi Nakamoto. Except now Craig Wright is claiming he is the real Satoshi Nakamoto. This isn't actually the first time that Wright is reported to be Nakamoto, says Jerry Britu. He's executive director of Coin Center in Washington.
Craig Wright is somebody who was outed as Satoshi by Wired and Gizmodo a few months back. He's an Australian. He fled Australia. We haven't heard from him since. But at the time, the evidence was given to Wired and Gizmodo. One, you know, Wired claims by a hacker, Gizmodo by a leaker, turned out to have been bogus. Several cryptographers looked at the evidence and said, no, this really does not add up. So the idea was raised that maybe this had been planted by Craig Wright. And when you look at Craig Wright a little bit more, You learn, for example, that he is called Dr. Craig Wright, but there's no evidence that he has any doctorates. He claims to have been working on a supercomputer project with Silicon Graphics International and SGI, then said, we've never heard of this guy. So he sort of became a person who was discredited as Satoshi. And then we've heard rumors starting a few weeks back that Craig Wright would reveal himself as Satoshi. To me, he starts at a sort of credibility deficit.
You do or you do not believe his claim?
I don't believe his claim, or at least I should say I don't believe his claim at this time.
Mm. Have we ever seen pictures of Satoshi Nakamoto? I mean, what is the depth of his anonymity?
He's completely anonymous or pseudonymous. We know he is Satoshi. We have many communications with Satoshi. Satoshi communicated and collaborated with dozens of individuals in developing the Bitcoin software and the Bitcoin network. And so many of his writings are public. And so we have a sense of Satoshi only from his writings, but nobody has ever seen him or heard him speak.
Are we sure he's a he?
We're not. We're not sure he's a he or a she or a they. Potentially, Satoshi is a pseudonym for a group of people.
So the question I have is, why does it matter? I mean, does it change anything to know the identity for real of Satoshi Nakamoto and what he or she was trying to achieve with Bitcoin?
So I think there are two parts to that question. One is, does it change anything in Bitcoin? And the answer to that, I think, is no. I think that today, if Satoshi were to reveal himself, the Bitcoin community would be thankful to him for what he created, would praise him, would invite him to continue to contribute to the Bitcoin project. But the Bitcoin project today is one that has dozens of developers and hundreds of companies in the ecosystem all working on the protocol and the project. So it's really not going to change anything. It's not as if he is going to have any special influence over the project. Where I think it matters, I think it is a matter of public interest. Here's a person who created something that many smart folks believe is as revolutionary as the internet. And we don't know who that is. And this is also somebody who today, there are several hundred millions of dollars that exist in Bitcoin that have not been ever touched, but that belong to Satoshi, or that at the very least, Satoshi, if he has the right credentials, could access and control, and they're his. And so I think that drives interest. You can imagine why somebody would want to be Satoshi. You'd be, you know, almost a billionaire.
Mm. Maybe Satoshi Nakamoto is just a name on the bottom of a coffee cup like Kobayashi and The Usual Suspects. They don't actually exist. It's just...
Somebody existed. Somebody published a white paper describing this innovation that, you know, was a breakthrough. It was an aha moment for everybody who read it. And somebody coded the first instance of the software, putting that innovation into practice. So, you know, Satoshi, he or she or they are out there. But it's interesting that one thing we do know about Satoshi is that he cares about his privacy a whole lot, so much so that he has never taken credit for this, has never claimed the hundreds of millions of dollars that he could potentially claim. And yet here we have somebody, Craig Wright, who is working with a PR company to get exclusives to several magazines and newspapers, trying to create a media campaign to out himself as Satoshi. These things, you know, don't add up.
Has this claim by Craig Wright affected the value of Bitcoin today?
You know, there's been a slight dip in the price today, but it hasn't been anything major. Bitcoin's a pretty volatile currency, and it's dropped a few dollars today, probably attributable to this, but no, nothing significant.
Jerry Brito is executive director of Coin Center in Washington. Thanks for your time, Jerry.
Sure, anytime.
If Bitcoin seem like science fiction to most of us, here's a quick note in honor of another coin of the realm technology all of us probably use, the personal identification number or PIN. And let me just say, first of all, it's PIN, not PIN number. That's like saying ATM machine. Okay, dismount your high horse. The PIN was invented 50 years ago in Britain. Back in the mid-1960s, banking hours there were pretty limited. British banks stayed open only until 3 p.m. on weekdays. They were also considering an end to Saturday morning hours as well.
The probability of people getting to the bank was remote. They needed a system to provide access to cash 24/7. And the problem landed on my desk.
That's James Goodfellow. He was a young engineer working in Glasgow in Scotland. Goodfellow says he was not surprised he got asked to help. He'd worked in the U.S. designing access control systems, you know, ways to privately access places or data. So he used his experience and took the hardware at his fingertips to create a card containing a code. A user could input the code on a keypad. I'm using air quotes here, keypad. The machine would confirm the keyed number with the number stored on the ATM card. Things haven't been the same in banking since.
Yes, well, it's a very clean-cut way of determining what you're telling the machine, what you're inputting. Things like fingerprints and retinal scans and so on are a wee bit fuzzy.
Not to mention way off into the future back in the 1960s. Now, you'd think the guy who invented something as universal as the pin would have been able to cash in on his creation. Not so, says Goodfellow.
I did receive $15 for patent applications, but I was quite happy that I did a job, a very successful job. And for 39 years, I said nothing about it, so I was not really looking for money or even fame.
Asked what he did with those $15, Goodfellow told The Guardian he thinks he blew it on a wild night out, adding, "It didn't change my life." In fact, Goodfellow says the only reason he's come forward is because someone else tried to claim they invented the technology. John Baron Shepherd even won a knighthood in 2005 as the inventor of the ATM. To be fair, Baron Shepherd's version did appear before Goodfellow's, but records indicate that Goodfellow was the first one to the patent office. "You can imagine how I feel when I see bankers getting million-dollar bonuses," Goodfellow told The Guardian. "I wonder what they contributed to the banking industry more than I did." Goodfellow's conclusion? "It doesn't make much sense to me, but that's the way of the world." Coming up, Puerto Rico on the edge of bankruptcy, and I speak with photographer Anita Corbin. She grew up in London in the 1970s and 80s and embraced punk culture.
I think that it gave us a huge opportunity to be different, to break out of our parental home, to be rebellious. It was a good excuse to just go out there and see what life was like in London.
Corbin took portraits of the women in punk back then. Stick around and hear more about her photos and about what punk meant for London's young women. That's all ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The last time Mount Nyiragongo erupted, much of the Congolese city of Goma was destroyed. Now the fear is it could happen again.
Very fluid, very fast-moving, and very hot lava. It can flow right down into the city while still completely liquid.
Life on the edge of a volcano, that's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. So what do you do when you can't pay your debts? Well, most of us would think about declaring bankruptcy. That is not an option for Puerto Rico. At midnight tonight, the U.S. territory plans to default on more than $400 million in debt. The island's governor says he took the painful decision to miss a key payment in order to keep essential services going in Puerto Rico, including schools and hospitals. And this one missed payment is only a fraction of Puerto Rico's total $70 billion debt burden. Luis Trejas is a journalist based in San Juan. He produces the podcast Radio Ambulante. How is this financial crisis actually affecting average Puerto Ricans, Luis?
Well, this financial crisis, which has been going on for about a year now, has affected us citizens in Puerto Rico, residents of Puerto Rico, because of austerity measures that have been put in place. There are higher taxes across the board. A new sales tax is one among the highest in the United States. And also there have been limits on public services that are being put in place.
Where does Puerto Rico get its money? Like, what is the source of revenue?
Well, Puerto Rico has been going on about a half century program of industrialization, and we had several key tax incentives that were put in place by the U.S. Congress, which were phased out in the mid-90s. Once that was phased out, the government tried to keep the growth going by issuing debt with preferable interest rates.
I gather a lot of young people and workers are leaving Puerto Rico for the U.S. mainland, quitting the island. What did they tell you about why they're leaving?
Yes, there's over 250,000 people that left the island from 2010 to 2014. That's one of the highest exodus that the island has seen in its modern history. People are leaving from all walks of society. Young people are afraid of not having opportunities, but also retirees, doctors, teachers, they're all fearing for the jobs, and they're all feeling that there's a lack of opportunity in the island for them right now.
You know, I was in Puerto Rico recently, and one thing that really struck me when I went to the grocery store there is that there's very little local produce. And this is on a tropical island. So much stuff is imported from the Dominican Republic, from the United States.
Yes, it is. I totally agree with you. The latest figures I have is that Puerto Rico imports about 85% of what it consumes in terms of food. And that is a big concern, that number. And yes, it's a very fertile island. However, government policies that have been in place since the 50s have put their priority on industrialization. And that may start to change now that, you know, industrialization is not a component of economic growth anymore.
The U.S. Congress seemingly has done little to resolve Puerto Rico's problems. What options does Puerto Rico have left?
Puerto Rico seems to have few options left. There is the project that is going on in the U.S. Congress right now for a fiscal control board that would have maybe up to 5 members and could restructure some part of Puerto Rico's debt. However, because of Puerto Rico's peculiar status, it's not a state, it's not an independent country. It's very vulnerable right now, and it just doesn't have the mechanisms to restructure the debt that is weighing down on the island.
And the other thing about visiting Puerto Rico recently is that I started digging into the history and reminded that it was one of the spoils of the Spanish-American War in 1898. The island was ceded by Spain to the U.S. Is there any tendency today with Puerto Ricans to kind of play out the alternative scenario in their minds, one where Puerto Rico is independent?
Well, there's a growing sense that this in-between status that we have right now has played its course and that it's not really working for a whole lot of Puerto Ricans. A lot of Puerto Ricans refer to the island as the oldest colony in the world, and maybe this will result in a bigger push towards statehood. Statehood movement is a lot stronger than the independence movement, which garners about 3% of the electoral vote every election cycle. But yes, there is a growing sense that the status we have right now is not working and that we need to move towards some sort of sovereignty, maybe through becoming the 51st state, if that is even a possibility, or by becoming an independent nation.
Luis, what keeps you on the island? You must have had friends who've left over the years and probably thought about it yourself, have you?
Yes, I have. And I have left and lived in New York. But now I'm back. I have a young daughter. I'm a big believer in Puerto Rican culture and Puerto Rican nationhood. And my family is here. The weather is great, as you probably know. And if you're coming from Boston, yeah, you probably felt it at this time of the year. But yeah, my roots are here. I don't know how long I'll actually be able to stay. It's something that me and my generation and everybody around me thinks about constantly. Should I stay or should I go? But right now I'm here, and I'm hoping that my 2-year-old daughter will be around long enough to understand what Puerto Rico is and that she's Puerto Rican.
Reporter Luis Trejas in San Juan, thanks very much for telling us about what's going on down on the island right now.
Thank you, Marco.
Name pronunciation can be a tricky thing. I've had people misspell, mishear, and or mispronounce my last name many times. Instead of Werman, I've heard Warman, Verman, even Vermin. Okay, that last one goes back to grade school, and then it probably wasn't a mispronunciation. Anyway, I got nothing on my BBC colleague Nkem Ifejika. He's from Nigeria and is based in London now, and he assured me I got his name right. Nkem recently wrote about how he deals with people mispronouncing his name on a regular basis. In fact, Nkem, for some time, you even mispronounced your name, right?
Yes, I did. For ages, I always said my name was Nkem Ifejika. I thought that, okay, if this is the way that English people say my name, an English pronunciation, then I should say it that way as well. But it was when I met my wife, she would tease me. She was half scornful, half teasing. She'd say, you don't even know how to pronounce your name. My wife, by the way, is Nigerian, and she's Igbo, which is the ethnicity that I'm from in southeastern Nigeria. So she'd say, you don't even know how to say your name. And I did stop and think about it, because it's okay, I suppose, if other people mispronounce my name, because they might not have necessarily the vowels or know the tonal nature of the language and might not be able to pronounce the name themselves. But I thought that it was unforgivable for me. I mean, I know how to pronounce my name.
Fair enough to want to fit in, but what about authenticity?
Authenticity is so important because of the way that we're brought up in Nigeria and the way that children get their names. Names have meanings. And so Nkem means my own, like, you know, this belongs to me. And it can be used as a term of endearment. And then Nkemakona, which is the name in full, means may I never lack what is mine. So there's so many different things and so many different meanings which accompany the birth of a child and the child getting that name.
Nkem, you're half Igbo on your dad's side, and you lived in Nigeria until the age of 12. You speak Spanish and French fluently. You speak Yoruba, which is, along with Igbo, one of the 3 main languages in Nigeria. And you've studied Arabic and German, but you can't speak Igbo. Why not?
I can't speak Igbo. And it's a combination of things. It's been displaced from the Igbo heartland. So when I was growing up in Nigeria, I grew up in Lagos, which is in the southwest of the country. Igbo land is about 500 kilometers away in the southeast of the country. So I didn't get a chance to speak Igbo when I was growing up. You know, I didn't grow up with my dad. I grew up mostly with my mom. So she wanted me to have a more international outlook, which is fine. And there was also a feeling, a sense that Igbo will always be there. He can always kind of come back to it. It's not like a more international language, which is more important to grab hold of now, because this is what is going to get you into, you know, the right schools or get you into the right careers and professions. But Igbo will always be there, which is probably a dangerous thing.
Speaking of pronunciation, I'm pronouncing it Igbo, kind of throwing the G, the swallow G, into I-G-B-O. And you're saying Igbo. What is the right way? Is it Igbo?
My goodness, Marco. This is another complicated issue. No, you are bringing up a can of worms. So it's spelled I-G-B-O.
Right.
And it's actually Igbo. That's how you say it, Igbo.
Mm.
Now, when the colonialists came to Nigeria, they couldn't say the word, the sort of a hard GB sound. And so they just said Igbo, I-B-O. So I tend to go with Igbo as a sort of English pronunciation of the word itself.
So you're going back to your youth again, kind of following what the colonialists did.
Well, yes and no. It's just like nobody says, do you speak Francais or do you speak Deutsch?
Right.
So it's just for that reason, basically. But obviously, if I was speaking in Igbo, then I'd say Igbo.
So learning Igbo, what would be the challenges for you right now?
It's a tonal language, and one word can mean so many different things depending on the intonation. One famous one is akwa. So I think akwa is egg. Akwa is cloth. Mm. And akwa, I think, is to cry. I've probably mixed them all up, but just to give you an example of how difficult a language it is.
So you spell your name, first name N-K-E-M, last name I-F-E-J-I-K-A. When you're on the phone in the UK with an operator and they want to know what your name is, do you just like skip the pronunciation and just go straight to the spelling?
Absolutely. I just start spelling straight away. And I'm sure with your surname, you probably have a similar experience. I just go straight to spelling it. Otherwise, it'll be very complicated. I mean, I was that kid in school where the teacher, he'd pause and I'd just raise my hand and say, I'm present, sir. You don't need to trouble yourself with trying to pronounce the name. Once the teacher paused, I knew my name was coming up next. And I just say, yes, present in class. You know? And you kind of have, you grow up through life and you go through it and it's fine. And then you get to the stage where I arrived at where I have a public platform and I was mispronouncing my name. So if I don't say it properly, how will other people say it properly? That's what got me thinking. I could say the name properly, and so I should, which is what I started to do.
Nkem Ifejika, presenter for the BBC World Service based in London. Thanks a lot, man. Really appreciate it.
Thanks, Marco.
For our next story, let me take you back 14 years to Central Africa in the Congolese city of Goma, a place that was turned into a chaotic and semi-permanent refugee camp after the 1994 Rwandan genocide. And as if that trauma weren't enough, suddenly in 2002, not far from Goma, Mount Nyiragongo erupted. The volcano sent a river of hot molten lava into the city. 147 people died. 400,000 people were forced to flee, many of them back to nearby Rwanda. Another 100,000 were left homeless in Goma itself. The eruption effectively split Goma in two, destroying a third of the city. Now, after years of relative calm, the volcano is back. The World's Karen Peterson is following the story. And when we say it's back, Karen, what do we mean exactly?
To understand this volcano, you need to understand volcanoes in general. We have these images of like a science fair explosion, and that's not really the reality of what's happening with Mount Nyiragongo itself. I spoke to this meteorologist. He's a storm hunter. His name is Mark Robinson, and he's crazy about volcanoes. In fact, he was in the volcano just days before it sprung back to life.
This one won't go off like Mount St. Helens. When Mount St. Helens went up, it was an explosion, a gigantic explosion. And that was because the vent essentially was plugged and a tremendous amount of pressure built up underneath the mountain until it released and produced this gigantic cloud of ash. Nyiragongo is much more like the volcanoes in Hawaii, very fluid, very fast moving and very hot lava. It's not going to explode, but what it is going to do potentially is suddenly flow out of cracks in the side of the mountain. And if those cracks are facing the city of Goma, it can flow right down into the city while still completely liquid.
Right. And that's what happened, I gather, in 2002.
Yeah.
One of those pools of lava just dripped right down into the city. I gather that is not the biggest danger right now, though, is it?
Right. So the scarier thing is that there's Lake Kivu. Goma sits on the shores of Lake Kivu, and it's this gigantic lake. It's 1,000 square miles big. And here's Mark Robinson again explaining why that's so potentially dangerous.
There's a tremendous, tremendous amount of dissolved carbon dioxide in the lower levels of the lake. If the lake is disturbed, it'll go off, basically erupt in the lake itself, like as if you took a pop bottle, shook it up, and popped the top.
Yeah, and there's no escape route, so it's not like you're going to be able to evacuate people from the shores of Lake Kivu anytime soon. The other problem, too, is that if you're not killed in the initial explosion, all the CO2 in the air, you could be asphyxiated. So it's a gigantic danger to the people living there.
That sounds horrifying. What are authorities saying about all this? I mean, what can people do to protect themselves?
So the Red Cross has put up a couple of warnings. Planes aren't allowed to fly over the volcano right now just because of the gas that it's emitting. The Red Cross told people that they should avoid rainwater, using rainwater to clean or cook. They should be going for fresh water and washing the vegetables that they're growing. Because the ironic twist here is that having an active volcano makes your soil very good for farming until the volcano destroys everything that you just grew.
I mean, it's like, do you stay or do you go? I can't imagine what it would be like living next to this volcano, especially when there are these weird scenarios that could unfold.
Yeah, I mean, I really wanted to know what daily life was like kind of living in the shadow of this volcano. So I called up my friend, Willie Mutabazi. He's a friend of mine from the time that I was studying in Rwanda. He started up a tourism company about 2 years ago. And I asked him what it was like to go up there, because he goes up there about once a month and he was so unconcerned.
I don't know. I'm not scared. I just don't think about that it's happening in my ROPS if I'm there. And I don't know. Maybe I'm a little crazy, but if it happens, it happens. You know what?
Yeah. And you know what the reality is? Like, he's not wrong, because if you're at the top of this volcano, you're actually much safer than everyone underneath it. It kind of makes sense.
Because of the cracks and it's not coming out the top.
Yeah, it's not going to explode. So getting off the mountain might be a problem. But being up there, you're actually safer than a lot of people in Goma right now.
So after looking at all this, Karen, what is your take on what's going on with the volcano?
I think that we need to zoom out a little bit, because it's alarming to hear this kind of news about a volcano and it's over this town of people. But there's so many other more important things that need to be taken care of in the DRC, that this volcano that could erupt in 2 years or 200 years isn't really high up on the list of priorities. And actually, the park that the volcano is in, Virunga National Park, released a statement, a blog post, saying that this is the best time to come and visit the volcano because there's so many things happening inside and it's so beautiful. And they need the tourism. So I have mixed feelings about this, looking out a little bit, because it is scary, but there's so many other scarier things.
The World's Karen Peterson, thank you so much for the perspective.
Thanks, Marco.
It is beautiful and terrifying to see the images out of Nyiragongo. We've got some photos from Mark Robinson's trip into the crater. That's on our website, plus some really amazing footage of the new vent. That's all at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman with The World. They say if you remember the 60s, you weren't really there. Remembering the 70s and 80s is a little bit different. Maybe there are scars now where those safety pins in your nose used to be. But above all, if you were punk back then, there's the attitude. Because you had to have major attitude to spike out your hair in fluorescent dyes and wear high-heeled Doc Martens, men and women. And you're probably still headbanging to music like this. The Slits there with their song Typical Girls. Anita Corbin photographed the punk scene in London, specifically the women of punk. Her pictures are now on exhibit at a gallery in London. The show is called Visible Girls. Anita joins me from our studios at the BBC. I mean, I clearly remember the punk scene in New York, Anita, but it was not London. I know that. That was the source. What defined the London punk scene for you?
Oh, well, I was in 1977, I was 18, and I think that it gave us a huge opportunity to be different, to break out of our parental home, to be rebellious. It was a good excuse to just go out there and see what life was like in London.
And it wasn't just a punk scene, it was many different scenes. Did everybody kind of come to the same center of gravity, though, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I actually started my series called Visible Girls in 1980, which was about less than a year after Margaret Thatcher had become Prime Minister. And it was a huge period of upheaval and protest. And I think the time when I started taking the Visible Girls pictures was absolutely ripe for subversive cultures, diverse subversive cultures, to exist within that sort of political framework.
As a young photographer, I would guess it must have been total eye candy, especially the punk scene. What drew you to it? Were you also a punk, and was photography your way in?
Yeah, I mean, I started taking pictures when I was very young, so age 8, actually. So I'd always been surrounded by images of my family and friends. And I was studying as a young photographer at a university in London and finding my way, looking for my own identity. And I kind of identified more with the punk tribe, if you like, a soft punk, though. Didn't have the piercings. I did have the bright pink hair and the bright green hair,
right,
and the crazy mohair tops. So I started to look at girls in subcultures as a young woman photographer in London. I wanted to celebrate what we as young women were doing at the early 80s and how punk really had given us an opportunity to be different, wear different types of clothes, you know, not have to stay to the mainstream look of fashion. So I went into pubs and clubs and met girls and often took them into the ladies for a bit of peace and quiet from the boys.
The ladies' room.
The ladies' room, yeah. To take some portraits. And they're all double portraits, which is...
What does that mean?
Well, there are two young women in each portrait.
I see.
And often they were sisters, often friends, sometimes lovers. And really the power of the portrait that has lived on 35 years is a relationship between the girls in the picture, but also the third person, me as a photographer, kind of looking into our lives of that time.
So, I mean, I think punk and I think that loud raunch of, you know, the Johnny Rotten, Sid Vicious types. The women of punk, were they a big minority? And what were they rebelling against?
Well, there was the fantastic X-ray specs, polystyrene, headed up that. I guess we were showing the world who we were. We were, you know, outside of the stereotype, the mainstream fashion culture. I guess it was really kind of a feminist rebellion as well. There was an element of a political nature, as well as obviously the music and the dancing and the gathering together of the tribe, if you like.
I mean, many people point to the politics and inclusiveness and the free spirit that made punk what it was and let everybody do their own thing. Others say punk, even though there was this feminist thing going on, as you say, it was sexist and that the female punk spirit was not taken seriously. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent, you know, there was an element of not wanting to give up the power. But I guess by focusing on the women rather than the boys in the subculture, I was celebrating how far we'd come and making that point that, yes, we are here, despite, you know, maybe not being noticed all the time. And the girls that I met certainly were very, very out there with their ideas and dress and politics and also wanting to be part of a wider picture of a subculture, including lots of ska and reggae and, you know, integrating the sort of anti-racist politics as well.
Right. No, definitely bridge that gap between young Brits and West Indians. So there's this great picture of some of the women you photographed back in the 70s and 80s at the exhibition now, and they're all grown up. What are they like? They still have that attitude? Is there anything they regret about that time?
I think it's you know, women can be quite self-effacing, and some of the young women that are now older women often say to me, "Oh, I look really grumpy in that picture." And I suppose we were, you know, we were making a point. We were teenagers, we were young 20s. That's what you do when you're that age. You know, you have an attitude, and I think we've all mellowed. A lot of us have had children. Now looking back at the archive, the pictures that I select in my 50s are different from the ones that I selected in my 20s, where I probably would go for one with attitude in the exhibition of the original shots. Looking back in the archive now, I've selected other images of the same girls, but with smiles on their faces or slightly lighter attitudes.
Does the spirit of rebellion, is it still there for some of these women who are now mothers?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we had a really powerful generation of women born in the 50s and early 60s. I think we were very fortunate that, you know, I turned 17 when the Equal Opportunities Act was passed. We were a kind of the first wave of that generation of women. And we were always marching and protesting about something. And yeah, there definitely is an energy of rebellion and being ourselves. My philosophy really as a photographer was to allow those young women to show the world who they were, not who an advertising or a marketing executive wanted them to look like. It was about showing the world how we wanted to look and how we wanted to be ourselves.
Anita, great to speak with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Photographer Anita Corbin there. You can check out some of her photos of the 1980s punk scene and also see what some of the musicians look like now. That's all at PRI.org. We'll close our program today with the perfect I Am a Poser by the X-Ray Specs. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.